Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan. In this presentation, we're going to talk about the French. It's one group that I haven't mentioned in any detail. And of course, the French, the competition, I should say, between the French and the English is going to determine in so many ways what happens later on in American history with the American War for Independence. The French were also important in some ways for the settlement of North America, which would later become part of the United States. So I will talk a little bit about that. The French, this competition is the most important theme to take out of this presentation, and how that competition is going to lead to war later on. So the French and English waged war either cold or hot for much of the modern European history. I mean, it's really only in modern history, say in the 20th century, that the French and the English have kind of buried the hatchet, so to speak, and become allies. But for most of European history, particularly back when you say date back to the Hundred Years' War, even go back to 1066, when the French essentially invaded England and conquered it, William the Conqueror, this is when this competition between the French and the English started. So you're talking about 1,000 years of history here, almost, where you have the French and the English really not liking each other a whole lot. And in the 18th century, 17th century, it's no different. In fact, these two powers were constantly at odds and constantly at each other's throat, and constantly, practically in the 18th century in particular, and most importantly, constantly at war. So the American War for Independence is very much going to be created because of this these conflicts between the French and the English. Now, early French interest was a little different than English interest. We've talked about the settlement, say, for example, of Jamestown and the other southern colonies. We've talked about the settlement of New York, ultimately, and Pennsylvania, which, of course, came later. But when you're looking at these early colonies, Jamestown in particular, Virginia, and some of the southern colonies, and then also in New England, which Dr. Woods talked about, you're starting to talk about the English, where they want to settle these areas. Now, the French were not necessarily interested in settlement early on. Their interests were more confined to fur trading, fishing, extracting what resources they could from these North American colonies, setting up forts along the frontier, but really not settling them like the English would. That would come a little later. But the French were here, in fact, very early, around the same time as the English. So in the 17th century. So they had been here just as long as the English. And when you look at, say, for example, modern day Quebec, I mean, that's a byproduct of that. Now, a man named Jacques Cartier would colonize New France in 1534. During that time, he would explore what is now Quebec. And then, of course, the French would actually settle Quebec in 1604. You would have a permanent French colony in Canada in 1604. So 3 years before Jamestown, the French were actually establishing themselves in Canada about the same time. But the French, of course, were here a lot longer before that, simply using these areas for their own resources. So you have a Cartier and Samuel de Champlain, the father of New France, establishing a foothold here in North America. And then, of course, you had Robert de La Salle. Now, Robert de La Salle explored the Great Lakes. He would explore the Mississippi, and this is why the French controlled Louisiana, of course, named after King Louis. Here you have the French controlling the interior of North America and what's now Canada. So really what you had in the colonial period was an interesting situation. You had the English along the coast, stretching from modern-day New England down to Georgia. But really the interior beyond, once you got to about the mountains, or even before that, the Piedmont area, that interior area was always in dispute. The French controlled what's now Quebec down through the Great Lakes and then all the way down the Mississippi. So you basically had the French on the interior and the English on the coast. And that that middle area is the area of dispute. They were constantly fighting over it. Who would control it? Of course, there are a tremendous number of Indian tribes in this area. So you have this conflict over, you know, who's going to have the best relationship with the Indian tribes. So all of this conflict eventually is going to brew over into hot wars. For a very long period of time, of course, you had a cold war between the French and the English. They just were not on very good terms. But eventually this cold war was going to spill over into hot wars. In fact, you had four hot wars between the French and the British in the 18th century. These wars began in 1689 and ended in 1763. So for almost 100 years, you have a series of wars. You have King William's War, Queen Anne's War, King George's War, and then later the French and Indian War, which is also called the Seven Years' War in Europe. So that last war had a profound impact for the establishment of the United States and the separation of the states from the British in 1776. The French and Indian War then becomes the war that we'll talk about mostly in this particular presentation. But again, what I want you to get out of this is that the French, this French cultural influence is, you know, very much still in the United States. When you look at Louisiana, for example, there you have, you don't have counties, you have parishes, because the French, of course, were Catholic. And so when they settled Louisiana, that element is going to remain. Parishes instead of counties. Of course, the Americans also believed later on, when you start looking at, for example, the War of 1812, that the French were in so many ways their natural allies in Canada, and that the people in Quebec would want to separate from Canada. And even to this day, there is a strong independence movement in Quebec looking to separate from Canada. Of course, it almost happened in the 1990s, but it's kind of died down since. But And there's always been this strong separatist streak in Canada with the people in Quebec. And of course, later on, the French would become the natural allies of the Americans, at least in the American War for Independence, because the French and the British didn't like each other. So this is why the Americans go cap in hand to France in 1776 and 77 and 78, saying, hey, look, England is our natural enemy. We need to be buddies. And there are a number of Americans that really admired France. So, you know, in that way, politically, France is going to have an impact on the United States. But let's talk about this French and Indian War. It's going to last from 1754 to 1763. And it's really a world war. I mean, these intercolonial wars are world wars. Because they're not only fought in Europe, which they will be, they're fought in the colonies. They're fought all over the world. Wherever the British and the French have interests, they're going to be fighting each other. Tremendous naval battles, for example. I mean, this is really interesting stuff. But the important thing about the French and Indian War, there's a couple of important things. One, this is going to end salutary neglect in the British North American colonies. Because once the war is over, this is a very expensive war, the British are going to require more money to pay for the debt that they incur during this war, which they never really pay off. So they're going to raise taxes to do it. And not only that, they're going to start putting their thumb, more importantly, on the American colonists and requiring more of them. So from 1689, really, up until, or actually you could even go back to the founding of these colonies in many ways, 1607. Really, from 1607 all the way up until 1763, the British neglect the colonies, but that's beneficial for the colonial people because, of course, these colonials can then essentially, they can have their own currency, they can settle out their own laws, they can do things without British interference. But once these wars are over, the British are going to start interfering in ways they never had before. And so this is going to be cause extreme tension between these colonials in the British North American colonies and the mother country itself. Now, there are some important things that happened here. Of course, one thing is George Washington. This is where we're first going to be introduced to George Washington, and I'll talk a little bit about Washington's role in this French and Indian War. We're also going to look at something called the Albany Plan of Union and the Albany Congress. There was this idea early on to have some form of union in the British North American colonies, and I'll talk about that. We'll also look at William Pitt the Elder and the Treaty of Paris of 1763. So all four of these things are important for our discussion of how this war, this French and Indian War, is going to impact the future of what became the United States. So let's talk about George Washington. This is the first time we're introduced to him in many ways in the colonial period. Of course, Washington lived from 1732 to 1799. He was from a very prominent Cavalier family, and Washington grew up in this Cavalier society. He was considered, for example, the best dancer in Virginia, the best horseman. He was a real athlete. He was able to straddle both those worlds that I talked about in Cavalier society, being very masculine, but also understanding your formal rules in society better than most men. He was really a man among men, the most important guy on the colonies, the most respected guy North American colonies during the War for Independence, of course, leading up to that, and then later on. I mean, if you have to look at one particular person in American history and pick one who's the most important, you'd have to say George Washington is that guy. Now, he begins his military career actually during this French and Indian War, because he is sent by the governor of Virginia west to establish a defensive position along the frontier. When he gets there, he runs into the French. They already have done essentially what he was instructed to do. They have a fort called Fort Duquesne. And Washington is going to establish a fort called Fort Necessity. Well, lo and behold, the French and the English under Washington's command are going to attack each other. And Washington eventually has to give up. Now, when he signs his surrender at this point, he also unknowingly signs an admission that the French commander was assassinated in these particular hostilities. So Washington is, in so many ways, leading to the beginning of this great big war. He goes back to Virginia. At this point, he's only 21 years old, by the way. It means he's a major in the colonial militia, but he blunders at this point and in so many ways helps start this war. Later on, Washington will also be involved in what's called the Battle of the Wilderness, where you have a man named Edward Braddock go west to try to clean out the French there as well. And Washington barely survives this engagement. He's actually shot four times. He has a horse shot out from under him, a couple of bullets grazed through his coat. And he's the man in charge of leading the men back from this disaster, the Battle of the Wilderness, back into the colonies under British control. And he's also in charge of the defense for Virginia during this French and Indian War, setting up the defensive perimeter for the British there in Virginia. So Washington has an important military role in these colonies, even in this big war, even though he's not very successful. Now, this is where he's cutting his teeth, so to speak, and where he gets a reputation. In fact, the Americans are not very good in this war early on. They don't do very well, and it's not until William Pitt the Elder takes over the war in so many ways in England that the British are going to start doing better and ultimately win the war. Now, before all this happens, 1754, Americans are going to meet in Albany, New York, and they're going to discuss a defensive pact among the colonies. In fact, Benjamin Franklin is also going to make a name for himself here. Franklin, of course, had a name before this point, but politically, Franklin is already thinking in bigger terms than just the colonies. He, in fact, is a man who, in so many ways, draws up the first political cartoon in America, and it's a snake chopped into pieces where each piece represents a colony, and it's join or die. So the idea was that the colonies could be very well together, very strong defense, but if they're chopped into pieces, they can't do that. So this is important for our conception of union later on. You know, the union has specific purposes, two basically, commerce and defense. Defense was always seen as part of the union, and domestic concerns, though, were always left to the states themselves or to the colonies. There's no way Pennsylvania was going to tell South Carolina how the people in South Carolina should live and vice versa. And there's no way really that the people of Massachusetts were going to tell the people in Virginia how to live. And they really didn't see eye to eye on this stuff. Again, culturally, we've already talked about that, how different these colonies were. But defensively, they all saw that each colony perhaps, and then later on each state, had a common cause that they should follow. And so that's when our conception of union really gets put forward. Here, we're starting to see it in 1754. Now, the Albany Plan of Union is not adopted. In fact, Benjamin Franklin says this about the colonies. He said, "The colonial assemblies and most of the people were narrowly provincial in outlook, mutually jealous, and suspicious of any central taxing authority." So, again, this is going to carry forward. I mentioned that decentralization is the American tradition, not centralization, not big government, not central authority. Franklin is saying here in 1754 that the colonial assemblies are narrowly provincial in outlook. They're mutually jealous and suspicious of any central taxing authority. They don't want to pay taxes to a central authority. They've already got their own legislatures, their assemblies to do this. They're not going to have one more level of that. And so when you start looking at the Constitution or the Articles of Confederation, there's a reason why the Articles were so weak. And the Constitution only had certain delegated authority. Everything else was left to the states. That's because the centralization was never an American tradition. It was never the American way. It was always the opposite of that. Okay, so another person we have to talk about is William Pitt the Elder. He favored using everything at his disposal to win this war, and that's going to be important because he's going to reinforce America. They're going to get into a strong military offensive here in the North American colonies, attacking into Quebec itself, and this will ultimately work. But in the process, they're going to require a tremendous amount of money to do this, which is debt and loans. And so to pay these loans back and this debt back, they're going to have to institute taxes. And essentially, as I said before, these war loans were never paid back. What's interesting about Pitt, though, William Pitt the Elder, is that when we get to the struggle in 1776, Pitt the Elder actually favored the American position. He thought the American colonies should be free to break free from England. So he, along with Edmund Burke, these are very conservative men. And in so many ways, I mean, Pitt is called the Earl of Chatham. These two guys were so important in forming this this decentralization idea in England itself as well. I mean, look, if we have colonies that do not want to be part of England anymore, we'll just let them be. Why do we have to fight this war and blood and money that are going to go into keeping this empire afloat? So that position, that Burkean conservatism, you know, Pitt was very much behind that too. These guys were contemporaries and they saw eye to eye on this issue. There were a number of people in England who had the exact same position. And so that, again, is part of this, this real conservatism, this independent streak, not cultural imperialism, so to speak. I mean, the British, of course, were in favor of spreading their culture wherever they could. But if there was an independence movement, why sacrifice the men and material and money it's going to take to keep these people in check? So Burke, Pitt, were very much behind the independence of the American colonies, or at least supported independence there, and didn't favor fighting a war to keep these colonies in line. But ultimately, of course, the war is going to end, the French and Indian War, later the Seven Years' War in Europe, through the Treaty of Paris of 1763. And the important thing here, of course, is that France will cede all of New France east of the Mississippi to Great Britain. So the British are going to acquire a tremendous amount of territory from the French. Spain will also cede Florida to Great Britain. So the British now control most of North America. Very short amount of time, though, because within, say, 10 years, 15 years, you're looking at the destruction of this North American empire. So the war, even though it provides a tremendous amount of territory for the British, will ultimately sow the seeds of its own destruction because of the money that's required and because of the fact the British at this point think that the American colonies should pay for the upkeep of the army. They should pay the money that was required to fight this war. In fact, they say, well, we fought the war there for you. You should pay your taxes. You should pay for the army. We're using it to defend you. So they're going to start regulating trade more extensively. They're going to start doing some things that are just not well received in the colonies, prohibiting the colonies from printing their own currency, for example. All these things are a result of this French and Indian War. And this is going to lead to great conflict. And of course, the American War for Independence, which Dr. Gutzman does a very great job talking about in the time leading up to that, the end of salutary neglect, and then of course the war itself, and then later the creation of the Articles of Confederation and this union that I already mentioned. We're already seeing the seeds of it here in 1754, but the conception of union is not strong centralization, it's actually the exact opposite. For defensive purposes only, and then later on commerce, it's decentralization. To protect culture, protect these states from each other. That's why we have decentralization, to protect the people of, say, Virginia from the people of Massachusetts or Pennsylvania, whatever the case may be. That's why decentralization is the American tradition. It's there to protect the cultures, the homegrown cultures of those regions. And it always has been the American tradition. Okay, so that's our discussion of the French and Indian War. Hope you enjoyed it. And for the next few presentations, Dr. Gutzman will be taking care of those. So I'll see you again when we start looking at the 1840s. Until then, talk.